Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book that takes a deeper view at some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. For this episode, my guest is Eric Hall, who teaches history at Georgia Southern University. We are discussing Eric's new book, Arthur Ashe, Tennis and Justice in the Civil Rights Era, published in September 2014 by Johns Hopkins University Press. As we hear at the start of the interview, Eric had been surprised at the start of this project to learn that there had not been a scholarly biography of tennis star Arthur Ashe. The book that he ended up writing is thoroughly researched, revealing aspects of Ashe's life and personality that were usually overlooked in the typically positive press coverage of him during his life. Eric also places Ashe in the broader contexts of race, sport, and politics in the U.S. from the 1960s through the early 1990s. I'll add that the book is an engaging and enjoyable read. I learned a lot from Eric's biography of Arthur Ashe, and I enjoyed my conversation with him. Here's my interview with Eric Hall. My guest this week on New Books in Sports is Eric Hall. Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
So to start out, we typically ask our guests for a bit of background about themselves. So I'll ask you to tell us something about yourself, and particularly, why don't you tell us where you got your interest in sports history and the history of the civil rights movement?
Sure. Well, I grew up in a suburb that bordered the south side of Chicago, suburb called Calumet City, the fictional home of the Blues Brothers. And I grew up a huge sports fan, big Chicago sports fan, the Cubs, the Bulls, the Blackhawks, the Bears, unfortunately. And so I had a deep appreciation for sports growing up, would spend hours throwing a ball off my family's wall. And the community that I grew up in was also very racially and ethnically diverse, and it was a very changing community. So I grew up very acutely aware of race and ethnic tension. And the issues of poverty and things like that. So I was very much aware of it growing up. I attended St. Joseph's College for my undergraduate and majored in history. I wanted to be a history teacher in the high schools. And my advisor at the time, a wonderful historian by the name of Bill White, suggested my freshman year that I pursue a PhD in history and teach at the college level. And really, ever since that freshman year, I followed through and ended up at Purdue University. And initially, I started out as a historian working in the 19th century because I'd been told that jobs in the 20th century were very hard to come by, and the 19th century would be my best bet for a job. But I couldn't really escape my love and interest in sports. And, of course, Randy Roberts, a very famous sports biographer, was on the faculty at Purdue. And I began to kind of work with him. I did a paper with him on bodybuilding and started to kind of go into the area of sports. But eventually, I came to the topic of Arthur Ashe really by kind of happenstance, the way that many historians do. My wife and I were walking the streets of Ann Arbor, Michigan, one afternoon, and where she would eventually go and get a PhD. And we were talking about research topics for a seminar that I was going to be taking on African Americans in the 20th century. And my wife just sort of blurted out, you know, what about Arthur Ashe? What about writing about Ashe as a topic? And I said to her, you know, I'm sure that there's plenty on Arthur Ashe. I had assumed that there were biographies, multiple biographies, all kinds of stuff. But when I went home, I realized that in doing the preliminary research that there wasn't any kind of a scholarly biography on Ashe. And there weren't really very many articles or book chapters about him as well. So in really starting to research Ashe and starting to look at his background and his life, like most people, I knew that he was a very famous tennis player. I knew that he had died of AIDS. But what I didn't know at the time was the extent that he was involved in the anti-apartheid movement, the extent that he was a public intellectual late in his life in the United States, that his involvement in the civil rights movement. And the more that I did research on him and the more that I realized what a multi-layered, nuanced, complicated character that he was, I knew that there was not only a seminar paper there, but a dissertation as well. And Randy, who had played, who continues to play tennis recreationally and knows tennis like the back of his hand, suggested that this could be a very good book project as well. So that's kind of how I came to the topic of writing about Ash in general.
So this started as your dissertation research, as you said, and you have an essay in the back of your book on the sources that you used. And so Ash wrote himself and co-authored four autobiographies. But you also point out he was unusual among athletes in that he left his collected papers, which is, I would think, was just wonderful for a historian. So what did you find in Arthur Ashe's archive?
Well, just to step back here for a second, it is absolutely rare that an athlete would leave so much paperwork, both published and unpublished. There was a wonderful article in, I believe, Reviews in American History a number of years ago called Telling Truth from Tales, where they looked at sports books as it really being difficult to write about athletes who don't leave these records. Ash, you know, as you mentioned, had written a number of autobiographies, some a bit more ghostwritten than others. But his family, following his death in 1993, donated his papers to the Schoenberg Center for Research in Black Culture at Harlem. And, you know, if you were to go to Harlem now, you can look at, you know, 25 to 30 boxes of his personal letters, his personal artifacts, his scrapbooks. And what I found was somebody who was thought very deeply about issues, wrote many, many very in-depth letters on all kinds of issues, from poverty to amateur athletics to apartheid to eventually AIDS and HIV when he was diagnosed in 1988. So I found all kinds of letters back and forth between him and friends. One of the most interesting sections, which was actually multiple folders, was simply complaint letters from people writing about how they didn't appreciate the behavior of Jimmy Connors and John McEnroe when he was Davis Cup captain in the early 1980s. I mean, there are scores and scores of letters of people just begging him to do something about these two athletes. But there are personal scrapbooks, there are handwritten notes, just all kinds of really great materials, contracts, interviews that he had done in writing his book, Hard Road to Glory, the history of black, first history of black athletes. So it's just really a treasure trove that you don't have with most athletes, quite frankly.
Well, let's turn to the book, Eric. And to start, can you tell us about Ash's early background? So he grew up in Richmond, Virginia. So why don't you tell us about his family?
He grows up in Richmond in the late 1940s and into the 1950s, and Richmond at the time is a very segregated southern city, like most. He grows up in the north side of Richmond, which was really divided geographically from the rest of the city. The parks were under-maintained, the facilities were under-maintained, segregation was very much the rule in Richmond. He remembers growing up riding on the bus and seeing that line that separated the white from the black section of Richmond. And he's unique among black athletes because I think a lot of the famous black athletes didn't really grow up in very segregated southern cities like Ash did. But his mother passes away, dies when he's very, very young, due to complications from a pregnancy. And his father really kind of takes the onus of raising him. And his father is a strict disciplinarian. His father encourages him and demands that he read vigorously, that he always has a place to go, that he's never just hanging around. And part of that is to kind of that being a black youth growing up in the segregated South, it was a very, very dangerous place if you were wandering the streets or if you looked at a white person in the eye. So his father had these series of commandments for him. You know, he had to be at school at a certain time, and he had to be home 13 minutes exactly or whatever it was after school was dismissed. Otherwise, he would be in trouble. He had all kinds of chores and tasks that he had to accomplish. And part of why his father did that was because his father was aware of cases like the lynching of Emmett Till in 1955 and other incidents. And he really used discipline as a way to kind of keep his son safe and out of potential trouble in the segregated South.
So then how did Ash get involved in tennis then?
Well, it kind of happened by happenstance. His family lived, his father was a policeman in charge of Brookfield Park, which was the African-American park in Richmond at the time. So his family lived on a house that was right on the edge of the park. So he would spend a lot of afternoons in the park, swimming in the pool, playing football, playing baseball, running around. And one afternoon, he happened to watch a young tennis player named Ronald Charity, who was a star at Virginia Union at the time, and was just kind of watching him play, watching him hit. And Charity saw that he was interested in tennis and kind of came up to him and said, you know, what's your name? And he says, my name's Arthur Jr. And he knew the name because he knew his father was the policeman in charge of the park. And he says to young Ash, you know, do you want to learn how to play? And Ash said, yeah, I would love to learn how to play. So he learns from Ronald Charity and begins to learn the game in the fields of Brookfield Park. Eventually, Charity tries to register him for tournaments outside of Brookfield Park in Bird Park, which was the kind of white mainstream tennis facility. But they would always find a way to keep him out. Either his materials arrived, you know, too late, or they were incomplete, or you know, things like that. But you know, so he learned the game through Charity at a time when, quite frankly, many black players were, most black players were not, or most African Americans were not playing tennis. So it's sort of an unusual sport for an African American at the time.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask, you mentioned that he would be disallowed from these tournaments. So as he was playing, and particularly as he was growing into his teens, and it's apparent that he was a great player, he would still encounter racism when he would try to enter tournaments, not only in Richmond, but throughout the East Coast.
Elsewhere, sure. I mean, at first, he simply wouldn't be allowed to play. You know, like I'd mentioned, one of the key things, and this is not just for tennis, but other ways to keep African American athletes out, was to say that your application never arrived, it just never came, or was incomplete, or something like that. So he would get there, and they say that his application just kind of never got there. In other instances, he was allowed to compete in tournaments, but it was very clear that Walter Johnson, who would eventually mentor him out of Lynchburg, would have to drive the team there. They would play their matches during the day, then they were supposed to get out of the city by nighttime, that there wasn't supposed to be any lingering or staying in a hotel or hanging out. So even when he did start to integrate the tournaments, you know, he would hear parents of white players yelling, you know, the N-word at him and other slurs. So racism was something that he continued to experience well through the time that he was a player in his youth and into his amateur years.
And still, he was gaining a national reputation already when he was a teenage player.
Sure, yeah. I mean, he was so good. I mean, he was very much like a Jack Johnson, that it got to the point where he was just such a good player that you couldn't justify a reason why you would keep him off the court with white players. I mean, he was beating, also in the ATA, he was beating African-American players who were much, much older and much more experienced than he was as well. So at some point, he was starting to get recognized nationally, was ranked, and they just kind of couldn't keep him off the court with white players. And the fact was, too, he was a very, very disciplined player. He was a gentleman on the court. He never showboated, never threw his racket, never screamed. He was told to play any shot within two inches of the out of bounds line to avoid the appearance of cheating. He conducted it. He was often the classiest player on the court, and he knew as an African American at that time, the classiest player on the court had to be an African American.
So Ash went to UCLA in 1963 to play tennis, and at the time UCLA had a reputation as being perhaps the best school for talented African-American athletes. Jackie Robinson had gone there, Rafer Johnson, the decathlete, had been the class president. So what did Ash find when he went to UCLA? How did he like his time there?
He generally had a good experience at UCLA. Spent most of his time, quite honestly, either playing tennis or traveling with amateur tennis. Was not particularly involved in the movement when he was at UCLA. He did, however, realize the some of the smoke and mirrors that existed at UCLA. That yes, they had a reputation of sort of producing these fantastic black athletes, Jackie Robinson, among others. But on the other hand, you know, if you there were few fraternities that you could join if you were an African American. There were very few places to live on campus if you were an African American. That racism was still very much a problem in California and in Los Angeles. And you know, he would see this. The one instance that comes to mind is very early on. I believe he was a freshman. The Balboa Country Club, which is on the sort of halfway between Los Angeles and San Diego, issued an invitation for the UCLA tennis team to come play a tournament there. And they listed the players on UCLA's team, but Ash's name was absent from that list of players. And his coach, J.D. Morgan, calls him in and says, you know, here's the deal. We've been invited to play. Your name is absent. If you want us to make a big deal about this, we will. And Ash kind of thinks about it, and, you know, as a freshman, it's a tough decision. And he says, you know what, just go ahead without me. I don't want to stop other players from playing that, you know, eventually there'll come a point where I will be good enough and my stature will be big enough that I can make a big deal out of things like this. But at the time, you know, he understood that he was just a freshman and that perhaps the timing wasn't right for him to kind of make a movement. And he was very kind of contemplative as an athlete, always was, thought about things very deeply. And, you know, even with South Africa later on, he never wanted to keep athletes from having an opportunity to compete simply because of an incident involving him. You see that first manifested in that Balboa exclusion.
Eric, I should ask about the way that tennis worked in the 1960s, because it's a very different system from today, where you have, you know, teenagers competing in professional tournaments. So, and the divide between professional and amateur was very strong back then. So can you tell us about the tournaments that Ash participated in and how he established his reputation?
The tennis at the time was, and I talk about this in the book on a number of occasions, it was very, very confusing back then for sports writers, for fans, for everybody involved, because you had the amateur circuits, and which would have included Wimbledon, the French Championships, the U.S. Championships, where you would have these amateur players playing. And then you would have these professional tournaments where, you know, going back a little bit further, you had people like Pancho Gonzalez, who was a fantastic tennis player, or Jack Kramer, who were playing professionally. And you really didn't know who the best players in the world were because they never competed against one another. The pros couldn't play amateurs. The amateurs couldn't play the pros. So he starts in that amateur system and begins, you know, playing in the Davis Cup in 1963 for the first time, and plays at Forest Hills in 1959 for the first time. So he really stays an amateur for quite a long time. Of course, in 1968, you see the advent of the open era, in which Wimbledon becomes an open tournament, meaning amateurs and professionals can compete together at the same tournament. And the U.S. Open, the first ever U.S. Open, he's victorious. So it is kind of a confusing sort of deal, but he makes a name for himself, at least initially, in the amateur ranks before becoming pro in the 1970s.
And when he wins that first U.S. Open tournament, he's still an amateur, right? Because he can't accept the prize money.
Can't accept the prize money. Sure. He's eventually given stock. Somebody gives him stock shares of GM stock, which is not a bad stock to have in the late 1960s. And he's allowed to accept that. But the prize money goes to the second place to the runner up, Tom Ocker, at the time. But what's interesting? I mean, he comes in the finals against Tom Ocker from the Netherlands, and the sports writers kind of aren't sure what to make of it. You know, some have Ash as the favorite, others have Ocker as the favorite. It's a matchup between sort of two. I mean, it's very similar almost to when the Super Bowl first began. You had the AFC winner playing the NFC winner, and people didn't kind of know what to make of the matchup or the line or anything like that. But you know, Ash was, and I should mention too that his strength at the time in the 1960s was a servant volley player. For somebody who was very contemplative and calm and you know, very, very careful and calculated about the way he was, I mean, he was like, went crazy on the tennis court, going one end to the other, hitting the ball, you know, really hard down the line. His serve was one of the fastest the game had ever seen. And really, that's the sort of way that he went about beating Ocker in 68, which eventually that'll change in the 70s when his skills start to deteriorate a bit.
So something that I was unaware of until I read your book was that Ash served in the Army after mm-hmm. graduating from UCLA. So can you talk about that?
Sure. He when he's at UCLA, he has the opportunity to either join ROTC or he has the opportunity to continue on as an officer in the U.S. Army following ROTC, and that's the advice to stay in the Army following his graduation is really offered to him by his tennis coach J.D. Morgan. Morgan was a PT boat commander during World War II. And he was kind of aware of geopolitics and aware that there were little hot wars popping up around the globe in Korea and Vietnam, et cetera. And he knew that if Ash entered the Army as an officer, that he would have a better chance of avoiding combat potentially, or being placed in combat in a safer role, I guess, than being an enlisted man, being somebody who was drafted and forced to go out there. So. He graduates from UCLA and ends up in the U.S. Army, does the boot camp and all that. But eventually what happens is he's at West Point and serves as a data processor, and they kind of keep him out of action and use him more of a showcase. You know, he plays in the Pan American Games, he plays in other larger national tournaments, he appears in advertising for the Army about ROTC. So, you know, very much like Joe Lewis would go and have sparring exhibitions overseas, or other athletes would kind of go around and showcase their talents before the troops. He certainly was not somebody that they were going to send into combat. He was somebody that would serve them better as more of a symbol for the Army than anything else.
Mm-hmm. So I want to move into it, beginning at about the same period as the beginning of Ash's engagement and his awareness of civil rights issues. And so can you talk about how he gets involved in that? But also I'll ask you about he had quite distinct views from other civil rights activists. So can you explain that?
Sure. To go back to Richmond for a second, he was encouraged from the time that he was young by his father, by his first major tennis coach, Walter Johnson, to not really challenge the status quo, to understand that certainly things were not right, segregation was not right, racism was not right, but that the best thing he could do was to win on the tennis court, and by winning on the tennis court, he would do a lot more for the movement than by speaking up, especially at the time. So he was very, very much encouraged in Richmond to kind of keep his mouth quiet, keep his mouth shut. When he goes to UCLA, he begins to interact with students from continental Africa, students who have participated in the Freedom Rides and Freedom Summer, and begin to really say to him and insist that he speak out, that he's this athlete with a platform, and that he absolutely has to make a case. And part of what I think I argue, at least implicitly in the book, is that for an athlete of his stature at the time, you couldn't be uninvolved in the movement. You had to be involved in one way or another, that somebody was going to pull you in. But, you know, he has this very famous debate with Ron Karenga, now Maulana Karenga, about the movement. And Karenga says to him, who was a founder of the US organization and Kwanzaa, you know, he says to him that you have to speak out. You're this athlete on campus. You have to demand boycotts. You have to demand certain types of things. And Ash said, I'm not a screamer and a yeller. I'm somebody who thinks you should talk with people instead of just kind of standing up and screaming and refusing to engage with people. So where Ash is different, I guess, really kind of throughout the rest of his life in terms of civil rights, is that he will really sit down with his political enemies, and he will talk to them. And he always believed that if you can get in a room with somebody, if you communicate with somebody, that you can change their opinion at least a little bit. He was never one, at least initially, for boycotts, for disengagement, for divestment. You know, he believed that the best good that you could do was through incrementalism and through really kind of talking to to people. And so his journey to civil rights is a very kind of gradual one. He gives a speech in 1968 at the Church of the Redeemer in Washington. It's a very conservative and tempered address. It's right out of the pages of Booker T. Washington. He tells the congregation to don't blame white people, to focus on what you can control, that, you know, there are things you can do individually to help break down racism that don't involve boycotts or don't involve marching or violence. And at the time, I mean, it was a very conservative speech, criticized by some people for doing it. But it's really his views very much evolve over time, and I think it shows that as a historian, you change over time is very, very important. That these characters, although we think of them sometimes as static, they're simply not that way when you look at them from start to finish.
Mm-hmm. So you say his views evolved, and he gains more of a reputation as an athlete involved in politics in the 1970s and into the 80s. And still, and you write about this in the book, his political stances did not meet with approval from other politically active athletes during that time.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. He was criticized by Stokely Carmichael and Jesse Jackson, in fact, also, who certainly was not radical at the time, for really not kind of being as authoritative and as active as he could be in the movement, for being out there on the lines, the picket lines, for being arrested, for things like that. I mean, the one of the biggest examples where he ends up at odds with members of the international anti-apartheid community is when he insists upon entering South Africa in 1973, because I think this is one of the more important areas of his biography. He applies for a visa in 1969 to play in the South African Open, and he's denied that visa informally at first and then formally for what the government says is political and racial reasons. He had made a comment about how he wouldn't mind seeing a bomb dropped on Johannesburg. He had expressed support for African liberation movements throughout the continent, and he had been this really vocal critic of apartheid. And for all of those reasons, the government denies him the opportunity to play, even though he is one of the best tennis players in the world at the time. So because of that, because he's directly affected by apartheid, he takes a keen interest in fighting apartheid. He does all kinds of reading about it. Reads monographs and articles and learns everything that he can about apartheid, and he's determined that he wants to go to South Africa. He wants to visit the townships. He wants to meet with government officials. He wants to have dialogue with local journalists. And other members of the anti-apartheid community, specifically Dennis Brutus, who had been shot in the back earlier when he was and spent some time in Robben Island, were critical of him for thinking that he could make a difference by going there, that the best thing he could do for South Africa was to stay away, was to encourage divestment, was to keep athletes out, was to boycott South African athletes in the United States. And he never sort of went away from that point, especially at the time that the best thing he could do was to go and to talk to people. And that earned him kind of universal scorn among many people in the anti-apartheid community.
But his position on South Africa also evolved. He becomes much more sharp. And as you said, back in the late 60s, he said, I'm not someone who's going to shout. I'm not going to be arrested. But then he is arrested for his protests
Absolutely.
About South Africa.
Right. And I think for him, it changes. The Soweto uprising is what really kind of changes things for him, as it does for many, many people in the international community. And the Soweto uprising was a rebellion of young, mostly initially young and urban youths in townships who were objecting to a variety of things, past laws, learning in Afrikaans, which is considered a language of the oppressor, et cetera. This is just a blatant instance of government force used against unarmed populations in South Africa. Eventually becomes it expands, older people become involved in the movement, et cetera. And he sees that, and I think at that point he realizes what many people have been telling him for a while, which is that the only thing that's really going to change things for South Africa is if the university community tries to, or if, excuse me, if the international community tries to cut them off. to divest, to keep athletes, to keep entertainers out of South Africa. He's arrested in 1985 for protesting outside of the South African embassy. So he fights hard with athletes, artists and athletes against apartheid to keep people like Frank Sinatra and John McEnroe from performing there. So his views, he does change with the times, and I think realizes that his approach is maybe a little bit naive by the late 1970s.
Mm-hmm. So something that comes across in your book, Eric, particularly in the sections where you deal with Ash and South Africa, is that Ash was a beloved and internationally renowned figure in tennis during his career.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he really becomes a celebrity, this international celebrity. And he's very good throughout his life at marketing his image, putting out there what he wanted to have put out there. He's very deliberate about the comments that he made and kind of where he went and where he didn't go. But you know, he would often appear on the Tonight Show and would appear on television shows, and so people would have known of him. He was voted the most eligible bachelor, I don't know how many times, by different outlets. So while he was at the top of his game in 1968, 69, he sort of falls off and doesn't really regain form until the Wimbledon victory. He's definitely one of the more popular people within the tennis world, not just because of what kind of a player he was, but because he was a fantastic interview. He was just sort of an interesting all-around person, and a lot of people wanted to talk to him for a variety of different reasons.
At the same time, it was interesting, you know, for how much he's a revered figure. It was interesting to read other players' views of Ash, particularly the players whom he coached for the Davis Cup teams in the early 1980s after his retirement.
Yeah, I think, you know, not to let Ash off the hook a little bit here, but I think anybody would have struggled with that group, to coach that group. You know, I think even Bill Belichick or, you know, some of these great coaches today, Joe Maddon, would have had a difficult with those guys. I mean, Ash was he was an old school coach. He believed in discipline. He believed in deference. He had a very much an old school mentality. I tell you to do something and you listen to me and you do it with a smile on your face. Those players, McEnroe, Connors, Vitas Gerulaitis, Peter Fleming, were ego driven. They were very confident in their abilities. They thought they knew the way to play tennis. They were professionals. You know, they had marketing deals themselves, and so they didn't think that they needed any advice from him. I think the best quote that Ash that I can remember was Ash said something like, "The squad was a collection of individuals, each of whom was something of a star in their own right." So he's dealing with kind of a group of all stars, he's criticized. He's criticized for not being emotional enough. He's criticized for not yelling at the umpires enough, for not supporting his players when they're out there kind of making a fool of themselves. Pancho Gonzalez, one of the older Davis Cup captains, says to Ash, you know, "Hey, I know your heart's a little bit weak, but you've got to get up there and you have to be emotional and you have to support your players." And you know, so he receives all kinds of criticism on that front. On the other hand, as I mentioned earlier, he gets tons and tons, so many letters that he can't even read them all, from people who are yelling at him for not corralling these players, not controlling them, not disciplining them enough. So he's really kind of between a rock and a hard place there. I think to sort of talk about McEnroe and Connors together is wrong, in the sense that McEnroe, Ash really kind of liked McEnroe, I think, deep down inside. You know, McEnroe was somebody who always played for the Davis Cup team, kind of, you know, really was sort of a patriot, whereas Connors, he believed, was just kind of a self-centered person who did whatever was best for Jimmy Connors. So that's one instance where, you know, he walks away in 1985 from the Davis Cup. You know, and they had won a cup, but I don't think he would say that it was a success by any means. I think he was very happy to leave the cup in 85.
So I'll ask you what, so he retires in, it was 79 or 80 that he retires from playing after his heart attack?
Yeah, he retired 79 into 1980. He tries to kind of make a comeback a little bit, yeah. But it just doesn't happen.
So he's coaching the Davis Cup team, but then he's involved, you've talked about his politics, but he's involved in a raft of other activities during the 1980s. So
oh, yeah.
Can you kind of just give us the rundown of all the things he was doing during that period?
Sure. I mean, you could write a 900-page book about Nash, and a lot of it would deal with his activities in the 80s because he's just so overextended. He's coaching the Davis Cup team. Eventually, by the late 1980s, he's writing the first history of African American athletes, the first history book called The Hard Road to Glory, which looked at previously unknown African American athletes, of which he does all kinds of research, writes the book himself, whereas a number of his previous books have been ghostwritten. He authors a memoir with Neil Ander in 1981. He's still very, very vocal when it comes to South Africa. He's involved in the Artists and Athletes Against Apartheid, which it begins in 1983 with his friend the actor Harry Belafonte. So he's involved in that. He's giving speeches all the time to different colleges and universities and high schools, where he's really kind of counseling students to go to the libraries and not think that they're going to be professional athletes. And he also takes up the issue of Proposition 42, which was a very, very sticky situation late in the 1980s. And Prop 42 was where the academic requirements for students entering college who plan to compete in athletics were raised. So the bar was raised for students competing in athletics. And the argument was that some athletes who came to college were found to be illiterate. Other black athletes with scholarships never graduated. And Ash came down in favor of the increased requirements. He believed that black athletes would actually rise to the challenge and get better grades and study harder and do better. But he was opposed in that debate by John Thompson, a very big, literally and figuratively, person at the time, the head coach of Georgetown, John Chaney at Temple University, and, of course, the presidents of HBCUs and the NAACP, who argued that standardized testing was culturally biased. So he gets involved in a number of debates. He's doing all this kind of stuff, and so it's really I get tired just kind of thinking about all the stuff that he was doing in the 80s and in the different directions that he had himself in.
So we should talk about Eric, the circumstances then surrounding Ash's announcement that he had contracted AIDS. So he contracts AIDS in,
sure.
in 1988, correct? And then the announcement.
He contracts it in 83 from a blood transfusion,
okay.
but he doesn't. He's not diagnosed until 1988.
Okay, and then he makes the announcement in 1992. And this was somewhat controversial when the news broke. So could you explain the circumstances
sure.
surrounding that?
Yeah, well, he in 1988 he's diagnosed as having not just acquired HIV but having full blown AIDS by 1988. And they all knew he and his wife and their friends knew that it was a death sentence in 88. So he really tries to kind of keep it quiet. He says he's keeping it quiet because of his daughter Camera, who was very young at the time and didn't want the disease to define him for her. And he also didn't want the disease to kind of overshadow some of his other charitable activities and his anti-apartheid activism. And you actually see what you can find if you go into the Ash papers in Schoenberg is you see these letters being exchanged back and forth between him and friends talking about, what's going to happen when the press finds out about this, because they are going to find out about it. How are we going to get out in front of this story when it finally becomes public knowledge? So in 1992, a writer named Doug Smith takes a call from somebody at USA Today who reveals this information about Ash having AIDS. So he goes to Ash's apartment to talk to him. Ash thought they were going to talk about his A Hard Road to Glory book, but he tells him that we have this source that says that you have AIDS and that we're going to have to go public with it because you're a public figure. And Ash, steps back and says, give me the name of your editor. He calls Gene Polinsky, the editor of USA Today, and really kind of argues with him about whether this is public knowledge, whether it should be public knowledge, that he's a private figure, he's not competing in tennis anymore. And ultimately, USA Today gives him a little bit of time to set up his own press conference with HBO, and where he's able to announce that he has AIDS on his own. But at the time, the USA Today's decision was widely criticized for kind of a violation of privacy. Why did people need to know that he had AIDS? And I mean, nowadays we think that. Of course, if we find out something about an athlete or a celebrity, that it is going to be announced. I mean, it's second nature now. But back then, it was very controversial that many sports writers and columnists felt that his privacy rights had been violated by USA Today.
And so then after this announcement that he has AIDS, Ash went to work on his fourth memoir. And you write in your essay on the sources, you write that Ash tried to reshape his legacy with that book. And I'll ask you, given your familiarity with the full span of his life and with his other writings, was there anything that stood out in that last book where you saw a man who had learned lessons or who had changed his thinking?
I mean, I think the most obvious example is his views on women, where, in the 1970s, during the kind of beginnings of the women's liberation movement, you had people like Billie Jean King, who were arguing that women, should be paid more, that they should get matches on center court, that they should be treated equally to men. And at the time, in the 1970s, and this is all public record, Ash was very resistant to that idea. He would say that, men are the exciting players. Who wants to go see women play? They play so nice and leisurely that, somebody like me or another athlete wouldn't be interested in seeing them play. That men are the breadwinners, that they need the money to support their families, implying that women's proper place is the home and that they're secondary income generators to the family. So he was very kind of resistant to that. He called them girls, he called Billie Jean King a girl and girls tennis. And, at one point he said in a memoir that if, my future wife, it needs to be a 51-49 split with me being, having that extra 2% to make those decisions. In that memoir, Days of Grace, he really kind of says that he was wrong back then, that Billie Jean King is one of the most influential tennis players, men or women, throughout the 20th century, and that his views were very much kind of misplaced. But he also says that he was kind of on the bandwagon with the treatment of women back then. He doesn't make the case that he was out there making comments at the forefront of men's resistance to women in tennis. So I think he kind of in some ways tries to lessen the role that he actually had in crafting that image in the 1970s. So that's kind of the most obvious example. But again, I mean, any of us who've done research on athletes or have done any kind of research on autobiographies or ghostwritten books know that people try to polish their images a little bit, that to really get the full picture, you have to do a lot of other research other than, reading somebody's autobiographies. At least that I would caution my students as well, that, don't believe everything that you hear, especially in an autobiography.
So, Eric, I'll ask what you're working on now. What's your new project?
Well, I'm actually sort of trying to figure that out at the moment. I've got a couple of ideas. Working on a couple different ideas. One set of ideas deals with kind of a smaller, 50,000, 70,000 word book, and then there's kind of a bigger project in mind. But the bigger one that I'm interested in at the moment is kind of going back to my hometown and doing something on the Chicago freedom movement in 1966. And possibly doing kind of a narrative of the entire movement. And for people who aren't familiar with this, this is the time when Martin Luther King and the SCLC and others in the South take the movement north in Chicago's west suburbs and places like Cicero to deal with job inequality and housing discrimination and urban racism. And they're met with quite a bit of resistance from blue-collar, white, and ethnic workers in Chicago. So I think it would be a story about the Southern movement coming north, being met with these forces that King had not really anticipated at the time. And, of course, Richard J. Daley is the mayor at the time, and there's the stories with him, and there's a major rally at Soldier Field in Chicago. And so and this movement is happening simultaneously to the James Meredith March Against Fear that Ferrum Good Susian looks at in great detail in his new book. But it would be an opportunity for me to kind of go back home to kind of look at some of the archives, interview some people who were part of that, and to try to tell that story in its entirety. But that's kind of the bigger project at the moment. I'm toying with a few other little ideas, but that's kind of where I'm at the moment.
All right, very good. And the Arthur Ashe book, I know, has been getting good press. So congratulations on that.
So far so good. It was reviewed positively in the Wall Street Journal and a few other places. But keep doing little. Did an interview with NPR and other things. So little reviews and opportunities keep popping up as the weeks roll on.
So have you thanked your wife for coming up with the topic?
I thank my wife every day, not only for coming up with the topic, but for a variety of other things. I mean, it's absolutely incredible to be married to somebody who's also an academic, who, by the way, her book is also coming out in March. She looks at Cuban musicians and entertainers in Cuban Latino communities in New York City and Miami in the 40s and 50s. So we're going to be a two-book household very shortly here.
You've been listening to an interview with Eric Hall about his book, Arthur Ashe, Tennis and Justice in the Civil Rights Era, published by Johns Hopkins University Press in 2014. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects like religion, politics, and biography. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. And please visit our related site, The All-Rounder, which features weekly essays and reviews about current issues in world sport from many of the scholars and writers you've heard interviewed on New Books in Sports. You can find The All-Rounder at theallrounder.co. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.